Side 2, Count Zero, by William Gibson. Continuing on page 37. Just to his left, but well out of range of the stim, two project girls stood, their Baroque finery in sharp contrast with Gothic monochrome. Long black frock coats opened over tight red vests in silk brocade, the tails of enormous white shirts hanging well beneath their knees. Their dark features were concealed beneath the brims of fedoras pinned and hung with fragments of antique gold, stick pins, charms, teeth, mechanical watches. Bobby watched them covertly. The clothes said they had money, but that someone would make it worth your ass if you tried to go for it. One time Two-A-Day had come down from the projects in this ice-blue shaved velour number with diamond buckles at the knees, like maybe he hadn't had time to change. But Bobby had acted like the wearman was dressed in his usual leathers, because he figured a cosmopolitan attitude was crucial in biz. He tried to imagine going up to them so smooth, just putting it to them. "Hey, you ladies surely must know my good friend Mr. Two-A-Day." But they were older than he was, taller, and moved with a dignity he found intimidating. Probably they'd just laugh, but somehow he didn't want that at all. What he did want now, and very badly, was food. He touched his credit chip through the denim of his jeans. He'd go across the street and get a sandwich. Then he remembered why he was here, and suddenly it didn't seem very smart to use his chip. If he'd been sussed, after his attempted run, they'd have his chip number by now. Using it would spotlight him for anyone tracking him down in cyberspace. Pick him out in the Barrytown grid like a highway flare in a dark football stadium. He had his cash money, but you couldn't pay for food with that. It wasn't actually illegal to have the stuff, it was just that nobody ever did anything legitimate with it. He'd have to find a Gothic with a chip, buy a new yen's worth of credit, probably at a vicious discount, then have the Gothic pay for the food. And what the hell was he supposed to take his change in? "Maybe you're just spooked," he told himself. He didn't know for sure that he was being backtracked, and the base he'd tried to crack was legit, or was supposed to be legit. That was why Two-A-Day had told him he didn't have to worry about black ice. Who'd put lethal feedback programs around a place that leased soft kino porn? The idea had been that he'd bleep out a few hours of digitalized kino, new stuff that hadn't made it to the bootleg market. It wasn't the kind of score anybody was liable to kill you for. But somebody had tried. And something else had happened. Something entirely else. He trudged back up the stairs again, out of Leon's. He knew there was a lot he didn't know about the Matrix, but he'd never heard of anything that weird. You got ghost stories, sure, and hot doggers who swore they'd seen things in cyberspace, but he had them figured for Wilsons who jacked in, dusted. You could hallucinate in the Matrix as easily as anywhere else. Maybe that's what happened, he thought. The voice was just part of dying, being flatlined. Some crazy bullshit your brain threw up to make you feel better. And something had happened back at the source. Maybe a brownout in their part of the grid. So the ice had lost its hold on his nervous system. Maybe. But he didn't know. Didn't know the turf. His ignorance had started to dig into him recently, because it kept him from making the moves he needed to make. He hadn't ever much thought about it before, but he didn't really know that much about anything in particular. In fact, up until he'd started hot-dogging, he'd felt like he knew about as much as he needed to. And that was what the Gothics were like. And that was why the Gothics would stay here and burn themselves down on dust or get chopped out by casuals. And the process of attrition would produce the percentage of them who'd somehow become the next wave of child-bearing, condo-buying Barrytowners, and the whole thing could go round again. He was like a kid who'd grown up beside an ocean, taking it as much for granted as he took the sky, but knowing nothing of currents, shipping routes, or the ins and outs of weather. He'd used decks in school, toys that shuttled you through the infinite reaches of that space that wasn't space, mankind's unthinkably complex consensual hallucination, the Matrix, cyberspace, where the great corporate hot cores burned like neon novas, data so dense you suffered sensory overload if you tried to apprehend more than the merest outline. But since he'd started hot-dogging, he had some idea of how precious little he knew about how anything worked, and not just in the Matrix. It spilled over, somehow, and he'd started to wonder and think. How Berrytown worked, what kept his mother going, why gothics and casuals invested all that energy in trying to kill each other off, or why Two-A-Day was black and lived up in the projects, and what made that different. As he walked, he kept up his search for the dealer. White faces, more white faces. His stomach had started to make a certain amount of noise. He thought about the fresh package of wheat cutlets in the fridge at home, fry them up with some soy and crack a pack of krill wafers. Passing the kiosk again, he checked the Coke clock. Marcia was home for sure, deep in the labyrinthine complexities of people of importance, whose female protagonist's life she'd shared through a socket for almost 20 years. The Asahi Shimbun fax was still rolling down behind its little window, and he stepped closer in time to see the first report of the bombing of A Block, Level 3, Covina Concourse Courts, Berrytown, New Jersey. Then it was gone, passed, and there was a story about the formal funeral of the Cleveland Yakuza boss. Strictly trad, they all carried black umbrellas. He'd lived all his life in 503 A Block. That enormous thing leaning in to stomp Marcia Newmark and her Itachi flat. And of course it had been meant for him. "There's somebody doesn't mess around," he heard himself say. "Hey, my man, Count. You dusted, bro? Where are you hidden?" The eyes of two deans twisting to follow him in the course of his headlong panic. 7. The Mall. Conroy swung the blue Fokker off the eroded ribbon of pre-war highway and throttled down. The long rooster tail of pale dust that had followed them from Needles began to settle. The hovercraft sank into its inflated apron bag as they came to a halt. "Here's the venue, Turner." "What hit it?" Rectangular expanse of concrete spreading to uneven walls of weathered cinder block. "Economics," Conroy said. "Before the war. They never finished it. 10 clicks west of here, and there's whole subdivisions, just pavement grids. No houses, nothing." "How big a site, team?" 9, not counting you. And the medics." "What medics?" "Hosaka's. Mass is biologicals, right? No telling how they might have our boy linked. So Hosaka's built a regular little neurosurgery and staffed it with 3 hotshots. 2 of them are company men, the 3rd's a Korean who knows black medicine from both ends. The medicine pod's in that long one there," he pointed. "Got a partial section of roof." "How'd you get it on site?" "Brought it from Tucson inside a tanker. Faked a breakdown. Got it out, rolled it in. Took all hands. Maybe 3 minutes. "Mass," Turner said. "Sure." Conroy killed the engines. "Chance you take," he said in the abrupt silence. "Maybe they missed it. A guy in the tanker sat there and bitched to his dispatcher in Tucson on the CV, all about his shit-eating heat exchanger and how long it was going to take to fix it. Figure they picked that up. You think of a better way to do it?" "No, given that the client wants the thing on the site, but we're sitting here now in the middle of their recon footprint." "Sweetheart," and Conroy snorted, "maybe we just stopped for a screw. Break up our trip to Tucson, right? It's that kind of place. People stop here to piss, you know." He checked his black Porsche watch. "I'm due there in an hour. Get a copter back to the coast." "The rig?" "No, your fucking jet. Figured I handle that myself." "Good. I'd go for a Dornier system ground effect plane myself. Have it wait down the road until we see Mitchell heading in. It could get here by the time the medics clean him up. We toss him in and take off for the Sonora border." "At subsonic speeds," Turner said. "No way. You're on your way to California to buy me that jump jet. Our boy's going out of here in a multi-mission combat aircraft that's barely even obsolete." "You got a pilot in mind?" "Me," Turner said, and tapped the socket behind his ear. It's a fully integrated interactive system. They'll sell you the interface software, and I'll jack straight in. Didn't know you could fly. I can't. You don't need hands-on to haul ass for Mexico City. Still the wild boy, Turner? You know the rumors that somebody blew your dick off back there in New Delhi? Conroy swung around to face him, his grin cold and clean. Turner dug the parka from behind the seat and took out the pistol and the box of ammunition. He was stuffing the parka back again when Conroy said, "Keep it. It gets cold as hell here at night." Turner reached for the canopy latch, and Conroy revved the engines. The hovercraft rose a few centimeters, swaying slightly as Turner popped the canopy and climbed out. White-out sun and air like hot velvet. He took his Mexican sunglasses from the pocket of the blue work shirt and put them on. He wore white deck shoes and a pair of tropical combat fatigues. The box of explosive shells went into one of the thigh pockets on the fatigues. He kept the gun in his right hand, the parka bundled under his left arm. "Head for the long building," Conroy said over the engine. "They're expecting you." He jumped down into the furnace glow of desert noon as Conroy revved the Fokker again and edged it back to the highway. He watched as it sped east, its receding image distorted through wrinkles of rising heat. When it was gone, there was no sound at all, no movement. He turned, facing the ruin. Something small and stone-gray darted between two rocks. Perhaps 80 meters from the highway, the jagged walls began. The expanse between had once been a parking lot. 5 steps forward, and he stopped. He heard the sea, surf pounding, soft explosions as breakers fell. The gun was in his hand, too large, too real, its metal warming in the sun. "No sea, no sea," he told himself. "Can't hear it." He walked on, the deck shoes slipping in drips of ancient window glass, seasoned with brown and green shards of bottle. There were rusted discs that had been bottle caps, flattened rectangles that had been aluminum cans. Insects whirred up from low clumps of dry brush. Over. Done with. This place. No time. He stopped again, straining forward, as though he sought something that would help him name the thing that was rising in him. Something hollow. The mall was doubly dead. The beach hotel in Mexico had lived once, at least for a season. Beyond the parking lot, the sunlit cinder block, cheap and soulless, waiting. He found them crouched in the narrow strip of shade provided by a length of gray wall. 3 of them. He smelled the coffee before he saw them. The fire-blackened enamel pot balanced precariously on the tiny Primus cooker. He was meant to smell it, of course. They were expecting him. Otherwise, he'd have found the ruin empty, and then, somehow, very quietly and almost naturally, he would have died. 2 men, a woman, cracked dusty boots out of Texas, denim so shiny with grease that it would probably be waterproof. The men were bearded, their uncut hair bound up in sun-bleached topknots with lengths of rawhide, the woman's hair center-parted and pulled back tight from a seamed, wind-burnt face. An ancient BMW motorcycle was propped against the wall, flecked chrome and battered paintwork daubed with airbrush blobs of tan and gray desert camo. He released the Smith & Wesson's grip, letting it pivot around his index finger so that the barrel pointed up and back. "Turner," one of the men said, rising, cheap metal flashing from his teeth. "Sutcliffe." Trace of an accent, probably Australian. "Point, team?" He looked at the other two. "Point," Sutcliffe said, and probed his mouth with a tanned thumb and forefinger, coming away with a yellowed steel-capped prosthope. His own teeth were white and perfectly even. "You took Chauvet from IBM for Mitsu," he said. "And they say you took Semenov out of Tomsk." "Is that a question?" "I was security for IBM Marrakesh when you blew the hotel." Turner met the man's eyes. They were blue, calm, very bright. "Is that a problem for you?" "No fear," Sutcliffe said. Just to say I've seen you work. He snapped the prostho back in place. Lynch, nodding toward the other man, and Weber, toward the woman. Run it down to me, Turner said, and lowered himself into the scrap of shade. He squatted on his haunches, still holding the gun. We came in 3 days ago, Weber said, on two bikes. We arranged for one of them to snap its crankshaft, in case we had to make an excuse for camping here. There's a sparse transient population, gypsy bikers and cultists. Lynch walked an optics spool 6 kilos east and tapped into a phone. Private? Pay, Lynch said. We sent out a test squirt, the woman continued. If it hadn't worked, you'd know it. Turner nodded. Incoming traffic? Nothing. It's strictly for the big show, whatever that is. She raised her eyebrows. It's a defection. Bit obvious, that, Sutcliffe said, settling himself beside Weber, his back to the wall. Though the general tone of the operation so far suggests that we hirelings aren't likely to even know who we're extracting. True, Mr. Turner? Or will we be able to read about it in the facts? Turner ignored him. Go on, Weber. After our landline was in place, the rest of the crew filtered in, one or two at a time. The last one in primed us for the tank full of Japs. That was raw, Sutcliffe said. Bit too far up front. You think it might have blown us? Turner asked. Sutcliffe shrugged. Could be, could be no. We hopped it pretty quick. Damned lucky we'd the roof to tuck it under. What about the passengers? They only come out at night, Weber said, and they know we'll kill them if they try to get more than 5 meters away from the thing. Turner glanced at Sutcliffe. Conroy's orders, the man said. Conroy's orders don't count now, Turner said, but that one holds. What are these people like? Medicals, Lynch said. Bent medicals. You got it, Turner said. What about the rest of the crew? We rigged some shade with mimetic tarps. They sleep in ships. There's not enough water, and we can't risk much in the way of cooking. Sutcliffe reached for the coffee pot. We have sentries in place, and we run periodic checks on the integrity of the landline. He splashed black coffee into a plastic mug that looked as though it had been chewed by a dog. So when do we do our dance, Mr. Turner? I want to see your tank of pet medics. I want to see a command post. You haven't said anything about a command post. All set, Lynch said. Fine. Here. Turner passed Weber the revolver. See if you can find me some sort of rig for this. Now I want Lynch to show me these medics. He thought it would be you, Lynch said, scrambling effortlessly up a low incline of rubble. Turner followed. You've got quite a rep. The younger man glanced back at him from beneath a fringe of dirty, sun-streaked hair. Too much of one, Turner said. Any is too much. You worked with him before. Marrakesh? Lynch ducked sideways through a gap in the cinder block, and Turner was close behind. The desert plants smelled of tar. They stung and grabbed if you brushed them. Through a vacant rectangular opening intended for a window, Turner glimpsed pink mountain tops. Then Lynch was loping down a slope of gravel. Sure, I worked for him before, Lynch said, pausing at the base of the slide. An ancient-looking leather belt rode low on his hips, its heavy buckle a tarnished silver death's head with a dorsal crest of blunt pyramidal spikes. Marrakesh, that was before my time. Connie too, Lynch. How's that? Conroy. You worked for him before? More to the point, are you working for him now? Turner came slowly, deliberately down the gravel as he spoke. It crunched and slid beneath his deck shoes, uneasy footing. He could see the delicate little Fletcher holstered beneath Lynch's denim vest. Lynch licked dry lips, held his ground. That's Sut's contact. I haven't met him. Conroy has this problem, Lynch. Can't delegate responsibility. He likes to have his own man from the start, someone to watch the watchers. Always. You the one, Lynch? Lynch shook his head. The absolute minimum of movement required to convey the negative. Turner was close enough to smell his sweat above the tarry odor of the desert plants. I've seen Conroy blow two extractions that way, Turner said. Lizards and broken glass, Lynch. You feel like dying here? Turner raised his fist in front of Lynch's face and slowly extended the index finger, pointing straight up. We're in their footprint. If a plant of Conroy's bleeps the least fucking pulse out of here, they'll be on to us. If they aren't already. That's right. Sut's your man, Lynch said. Not me. And I can't see it being Weber. Black-rimmed, broken nails came up to scratch abstractedly at his beard. Now, did you get me back here exclusively for this little talk, or do you still want to see our can full of Japs? Let's see it. Lynch. Lynch was the one. Once, in Mexico, years before, Turner had chartered a portable vacation module, solar-powered and French-built, its 7-meter body like a wingless housefly sculpted in polished alloy, its eyes twin hemispheres of tinted photosensitive plastic. He sat behind them as an aged twin-prop Russian cargo lifter lumbered down the coast with the module in its jaws, barely clearing the crowns of the tallest palms. Deposited on a remote beach of black sand, Turner spent 3 days of pampered solitude in the narrow, teak-lined cabin, microwaving food from the freezer and showering, frugally but regularly, in cool, fresh water. The module's rectangular banks of cells would swivel, tracking the sun, and he'd learned to tell time by their position. Osaka's portable neurosurgery resembled an eyeless version of that French module, perhaps 2 meters longer and painted a dull brown. Sections of perforated angle iron had been freshly brazed at intervals along the lower half of the hull, and supported simple spring suspensions for 10 fat, heavily nubbed red rubber bicycle tires. They're asleep, Lynch said. It bobs around when they move, so you can tell. We'll have the wheels off when the time comes, but for now we like being able to keep track of them. Turner walked slowly around the brown pod, noting the glossy black sewage tube that ran to a small rectangular tank nearby. Had to dump that last night. Jesus. Lynch shook his head. They got food and some water. Turner put his ear to the hull. It's proofed, Lynch said. Turner glanced up at the steel roof above them. The surgery was screened from above by a good 10 meters of rusting roof. Sheet steel, and hot enough now to fry an egg. He nodded. That hot rectangle would be a permanent factor in the MAS infrared scan. The dark was full of honeycomb patterns the color of blood. Everything was warm. And soft, too. Mostly soft. What a mess, one of the angels said, her voice far off but low and rich and very clear. We should have clipped him out of Leon's, the other angel said. They aren't going to like this upstairs. Must have had something in this big pocket here, see? They slashed it for him, getting it out. Not all they slashed, sister. Jesus, here. The patterns swung and swam as something moved his head, cool palm against his cheek. Don't get any on your shirt, the first angel said. Two-a-day ain't gonna like this. Why you figure he freaked like that and ran? It pissed him off, because he wanted to sleep. He was asleep, for sure, but somehow Marsha's jack dreams were bleeding into his head so that he tumbled through broken sequences of people of importance. The soap had been running continuously since before he was born. The plot, a multi-headed narrative tapeworm that coiled back in to devour itself every few months, then sprouted new heads, hungry for tension and thrust. He could see it writhing in its totality, the way Marsha could never see it. An elongated spiral of sense-net DNA, cheap brittle ectoplasm, spun out to uncounted hungry dreamers. Marsha now, she had it from the POV of Michelle Morgan Magnum, the female lead, hereditary corporate head of Magnum AG. But today's episode kept veering weirdly away from Michelle's frantically complex romantic entanglements which Bobby had anyway never bothered to keep track of, and jerking itself into detailed socio-architectural descriptions of Soleri-style mincom arcologies. Some of the detail, even to Bobby, seemed suspect. He doubted, for instance, that there really were entire levels devoted to the sale of ice-blue shade velour lounge suites with diamond-buckled knees, or that there were other levels, perpetually dark, inhabited exclusively by starving babies. This last, he seemed to recall, had been an article of faith to Marcia, who regarded the projects with superstitious horror, as though they were some looming vertical hell to which she might one day be forced to ascend. Other segments of the Jack dream reminded him of the Knowledge Channel SenseNet piped in free with every STEM subscription. There were elaborate animated diagrams of the project's interior structure, and droning lectures in voiceover on the lifestyles of various types of residents. These, when he was able to focus on them, seemed even less convincing than the flashes of ice-blue velour and feral babies creeping silently through the dark. He watched a cheerful young mother slice pizza with a huge industrial water knife in the kitchen corner of a spotless one-room. An entire wall opened onto a shallow balcony and a rectangle of cartoon blue sky. The woman was black without being black, it seemed to Bobby, like a very, very dark and youthfully maternal version of one of the porno dolls on the unit in his bedroom, and had, it looked like, the identical small but cartoon-perfect breasts. At this point, to add to his dull confusion, an astonishingly loud and very un-net voice said, "Now I call that a definite sign of life, Jackie. If the prognosis ain't looking up yet, at least something is." And then went spinning back into the all-glitz universe of Michelle Morgan Magnum, who was desperately struggling to prevent Magnum AG's takeover by the sinister Shikoku-based Nakamura Industrial Clan, represented in this case by, plot complication, Michelle's main squeeze for the season, wealthy but somehow grindingly in need of additional billions, new Soviet boy politician Vasily Suslov, who looked and dressed remarkably like the Gothics in Leon's. The episode seemed to be reaching some sort of climax. An antique BMW fuel cell conversion had just been strafed by servo-piloted miniature West German helicopters on the street below Covina Concourse Courts. Michelle Morgan Magnum was pistol-whipping her treacherous personal secretary with a nickel-plated Nambu, and Suslov, who Bobby was coming increasingly to identify with, was casually preparing to get his ass out of town with a gorgeous female bodyguard who was Japanese but reminded Bobby intensely of another one of the dream girls on his holoporn unit, when someone screamed. Bobby had never heard anyone scream that way, and there was something horribly familiar about the voice, but before he could start to worry about it, those blood-red honeycombs came swirling in again and made him miss the end of People of Importance. Still, some part of him thought, as red went to black, he could always ask Marcia how it came out. "Open your eyes, man. That's it. Light too bright for you?" It was, but it didn't change. White. White. He remembered his head exploding years away, pure white grenade in that cool wind desert dark. His eyes were open, but he couldn't see. Just white. "Now, I'd leave you down ordinarily, boy in your condition, but the people paying me for this say get a jump on, so I'm waking you up before I'm done. You wondering why you can't see shit, right? Just light. That's all you can see. That's right. What we got here is a neural cutout. Now, between you and me, this thing come out of a sex shop, but there's no reason not to use it in medicine if we want to. And we do want to, because you're still hurting bad. And anyway, it keeps you still while I get on with it." The voice was calm and methodical. "Now, your big problem, that was your back, but I took care of that with a stapler and a few feet of cloth. You can't get any plastic work here, you understand, but the honeys'll think those scars are real interesting. What I'm doing now is I'm cleaning this one on your chest. Then I'll zip a little claw down that, and we're all done. Except you better move easy for a couple of days, or you'll pull a staple. I got a couple of derms on you, and I'll stick on a few more. Meantime, I'm going to click your sensorium up to audio and full visual so you can get into being here. Don't mind the blood. It's all yours, but there isn't any more coming. White curdled to gray cloud, objects taking form with the slow deliberation of a dust vision. He was flat against a padded ceiling, staring straight down at a blood-stained white doll that had no head at all, only a greenish-blue surgical lamp that seemed to sprout from its shoulders. A black man in a stained green smock was spraying something yellow into a shallow gash that ran diagonally from just above the doll's pelvic bone to just below its left nipple. He knew the man was black because his head was bare, bare and shaven, slick with sweat. His hands were covered in tight green gloves, and all that Bobby could see of him was the gleaming crown of his head. There were pink and blue derma discs stuck to the skin on either side of the doll's neck. The edges of the wound seemed to have been painted with something that looked like chocolate syrup, and the yellow spray made a hissing sound as it escaped from its little silver tube. Then Bobby got the picture, and the universe reversed itself sickeningly. The lamp was suspended from the ceiling was mirrored, and he was the doll. He seemed to snap back on a long elastic cord, back through the red honeycombs, to the dream room where the black girl sliced pizza for her children. The water knife made no sound at all, microscopic grit suspended in a needle stream of high-speed water. The thing was intended to cut glass and alloy, Bobby knew, not to slice microwaved pizza. And he wanted to scream at her because he was terrified she'd take off her thumb without even feeling it. But he couldn't scream, couldn't move or make a sound at all. She lovingly sliced the last piece, towed the kick plate that shut the knife down, transferred the sliced pizza to a plain white ceramic platter, then turned toward the rectangle of blue beyond the balcony, where her children were... No, Bobby said, way down in himself. No way! Because the things that wheeled and plunged for her weren't hang-gliding kids, but babies, the monstrous babies of Marcia's dream, and the tattered wings of confusion of pink bone, metal, patched taut membranes of scrap plastic. He saw their teeth. Whoa, said the black man. Lost you for a second. Not for long, you understand. Just maybe a New York minute. His hand in the mirrors overhead took a flat spool of blue transparent plastic from the bloody cloth beside Bobby's ribs. Delicately, with thumb and forefinger, he drew out a length of some sort of brown beaded plastic. Minute points of light flashed along its edges and seemed to quiver and shift. Claw, he said, and with his other hand thumbed some sort of integral cutter in the sealed blue spool. Now the length of beaded stuff swung free and began to writhe. Good shit, he said, bringing the thing into Bobby's line of sight. New. What they use in Chiba now. It was brown, headless, each bead a body segment, each segment edged with pale shining legs. Then, with a conjurer's flick of his green-gloved wrists, he laid the centipede down the length of the open wound and pinched delicately at the final segment, the one nearest Bobby's face. As the segment came away, it withdrew a glittering black thread that had served the thing as a nervous system. And as that went, each set of claws locked shut in turn, zipping the slash tight as a new leather jacket. Now you see, said the black man, mopping the last of the brown syrup away with a wet white pad. That wasn't so bad, was it? His entrance to Two-A-Day's apartment wasn't anything like the way he'd so often imagined it. To begin with, he'd never imagined being wheeled in a wheelchair that someone had appropriated from St. Mary's maternity, the name and a serial number neatly laser-etched on the dull chrome of the left armrest. The woman who was wheeling him would have fitted neatly enough into one of his fantasies. Her name was Jackie, one of the two project girls he'd seen at Leon's, and, he'd come to understand, one of his two angels. The wheelchair was silent as it glided across the scabrous gray wall-to-wall of the apartment's narrow entranceway, but the gold bangles on Jackie's fedora tinkled cheerfully as she pushed him along. And he'd never imagined that Two-A-Day's place would be quite this large, or that it would be full of trees. Pi, the doctor, who'd been careful to explain that he wasn't a doctor, just someone who helped out sometimes, had settled back on a torn bar stool in his makeshift surgery, peeled off his bloody green gloves, lit a menthol cigarette, and solemnly advised Bobby to take it real easy for the next week or so. Minutes later, Jackie and Rhea, the other angel, had wrestled him into a pair of wrinkled black pajamas that looked like something out of a very cheap ninja kino, deposited him in the wheelchair, and set out for the central stem of elevators at the Arcology's core. Thanks to an additional 3 derms from Pye's store of drugs, one of them charged with a good 2,000 mics of endorphin analog, Bobby was alert and feeling no pain. "Where's my stuff?" he protested, as they rolled him out into a corridor grown perilously narrow with decades of retrofitted ducts and plumbing. "Where's my clothes and my deck and everything?" "Your clothes, hun, such as they were, are taped up in a plastic bag waiting for Pye to shit-can 'em. Pye had to cut 'em off you on the slab, and they weren't but bloody rags to begin with. If your deck was in your jacket, down the back, I'd say the boys who chopped you out got it. Damn near got you in the process. And you ruined my Sally Stanley shirt, you little shithead." Angel Rhea didn't seem too friendly. "Oh," Bobby said as they rounded a corner. "Right. Well, did you happen to find a screwdriver in there? Or a credit chip?" "No chip, baby. But if the screwdriver's the one with the 210 new ones screwed into the handle, that's the price of my new shirt." Two-a-day didn't look as though he was particularly glad to see Bobby. In fact, it almost seemed as if he didn't see him at all. Looked straight through him to Jackie and Rhea, and showed his teeth in a smile that was all nerves and sleep-like. They wheeled Bobby close enough that he saw how yellow Two-a-Day's eyeballs looked, almost orange in the pinky-purple glow of the grow-light tubes that seemed to dangle at random from the ceiling. "What took you, bitches?" the wereman asked, but there was no anger in his voice, only bone weariness and something else. Something Bobby couldn't identify at first. "Pye," Jackie said, swaggering past the wheelchair to take a package of Chinese cigarettes from the enormous wooden slab that served Two-a-Day as a coffee table. "He's a perfectionist, old Pye." "Learned that in vet school," Rhea added, for Bobby's benefit. "Except usually he's too wasted. Nobody'd let him work on a dog." "So," Two-a-Day said, and finally let his eyes rest on Bobby. "You gonna make it?" And his eyes were so cold, so tired and clinical, so far removed from the hustling manic bullshitter's act that Bobby had taken for the man's personality, that Bobby could only lower his own eyes, face burning, and lock his gaze on the table. Nearly 3 meters long and slightly over 1 meter wide, it was strapped together from timbers thicker than Bobby's thigh. It must have been in the water once, he thought. Sections still retained the bleached, silvery patina of driftwood, like the log he remembered playing beside a long time ago in Atlantic City. But it hadn't seen water for a long time, and the top was a dense mosaic of candle drippings, wine stains, oddly shaped overspray marks in matte black enamel, and the odd burns left by hundreds of cigarettes. It was so crowded with food, garbage, and gadgets that it looked as though some street vendor had set up to unload hardware, then decided to have dinner. There were half-eaten pizzas, krill balls in red sauce, and Bobby's stomach began to churn. Beside cascading stacks of software, smudged glasses with cigarettes crushed out in purple wine dregs, a pink styrene tray with neat rows of stale-looking canapés, open and unopened cans of beer, an antique Gerber combat dagger that lay unsheathed on a flat block of polished marble, at least 3 pistols, and perhaps 2 dozen pieces of cryptic-looking console gear, the kind of cowboy equipment that ordinarily would have made Bobby's mouth water. Now his mouth was watering for a slice of cold krill pizza, but his hunger was nothing in the face of his abrupt humiliation at seeing that Two-a-Day just didn't care. Not that Bobby had thought of him as a friend, exactly, but he definitely had something invested in the idea that Two-a-Day saw him as someone, somebody with talent and initiative and a chance of getting out of Berrytown. But Two-a-Day's eyes told him he was nobody in particular, and a Wilson at that. "Look here, my man," someone said, "not Two-a-day." And Bobby looked up. Two other men flanked Two-a-day on the fat chrome and leather couch, both of them black. The one who'd spoken wore a gray robe of some kind and antique plastic-framed glasses. The frames were square and oversized and seemed to lack lenses. The other man's shoulders were twice as wide as Two-a-day's, but he wore the kind of plain black two-piece suit you saw on Japanese businessmen in kinos. His spotless white French cuffs were closed with bright rectangles of gold microcircuitry. "It's a shame we can't let you have some downtime to heal up," the first man said, "but we have a bad problem here." He paused, removed his glasses, and massaged the bridge of his nose. "We require your help." "Shit," Two-a-day said. He leaned forward, took a Chinese cigarette from the pack on the table, lit it with a dull pewter skull the size of a large lemon, then reached for a glass of wine. The man with the glasses extended a lean brown forefinger and touched Two-a-day's wrist. Two-a-day released the glass and sat back, his face carefully blank. The man smiled at Bobby. "Count zero," he said. "They tell us that's your handle."
"That's right," Bobby managed, though it came out as a kind of croak.
"We need to know about the Virgin, Count." The man waited. Bobby blinked at him. "Vieille Mirac." And the glasses went back on. "Our Lady, Virgin of Miracles. We know her," and he made a sign with his left hand, "as Ezeli Freda." Bobby became aware of the fact that his mouth was open, so he closed it. The three dark faces waited. Jackie and Rhea were gone, but he hadn't seen them leave. A kind of panic took him then, and he glanced frantically around at the strange forest of stunted trees that surrounded them. The grow light tubes slanted at every angle, in any direction, pink-purple jackstraws suspended in a green space of leaves. No walls. You couldn't see a wall at all. The couch and the battered table sat in a sort of clearing, with a floor of raw concrete. "We know she came to you," the big man said, crossing his legs carefully. He adjusted a perfect trouser crease, and a gold cufflink winked at Bobby. "We know, you understand." "Two-a-day tells me it was your first run," the other man said. "That the truth?" Bobby nodded. "Then you are chosen of Legba," the man said, again removing the empty frames, "to have met Vieille Mirac." He smiled. Bobby's mouth was open again. "Legba," the man said, "master of roads and pathways, the Loa of communication." Two-a-day ground his cigarette out on the scarred wood, and Bobby saw that his hand was shaking. 10. Alain. They agreed to meet in the Brasserie on the fifth sublevel of the Napoleon Court complex, beneath the Louvre's glass pyramid. It was a place they both knew, although it had had no particular meaning for them. Alain had suggested it, and she suspected him of having chosen it carefully. It was neutral emotional ground, a familiar setting, yet one that was free of memories. It was decorated in a style that dated from the turn of the century, granite counters, black floor-to-ceiling beams, wall-to-wall mirror, and the sort of Italian restaurant furniture in dark welded steel that might have belonged to any decade of the past 100 years. The tables were covered in gray linen with a fine black stripe, a pattern picked up and repeated on the menu covers and matchbooks and the aprons of the waiters. She wore the leather coat she'd bought in Brussels, a red linen blouse, and new black cotton jeans. Andrea had pretended not to notice the extreme care with which she'd dressed for the meeting, and then had loaned her a simple single strand of pearls, which set off the red blouse perfectly. He'd come early, she saw as she entered, and already the table was littered with his things. He wore his favorite scarf, the one they'd found together at the flea market the year before, and looked, as he usually did, disheveled but perfectly at ease.
The tattered leather attaché case had disgorged its contents across the little square of polished granite. Spiral notebooks, an unread copy of the month's controversial novel, Gaulois non-filters, a box of wooden matches, the leather-bound agenda she'd bought for him at Brown's.
"I thought you might not come," he said, smiling up at her.
"Why would you have thought that?" she asked. A random response. Pathetic, she thought, masking the terror she now felt, that she allowed herself at last to feel, which was fear of some loss of self, of will and direction, fear of the love she still felt. She took the other chair and seated herself as the young waiter arrived, a Spanish boy in a striped apron, to take her order. She asked for Vichy water.
"Nothing else?" Alain asked. The waiter hovered.
"No, thank you."
"I've been trying to reach you for weeks," he said. And she knew that that was a lie, and yet, as she often had before, she wondered if he was entirely conscious of the fact that he was lying. Andrea maintained that men like Alain lied so constantly, so passionately, that some basic distinction had been lost. They were artists in their own right, Andrea said, intent on restructuring reality. And the New Jerusalem was a fine place indeed, free of overdrafts and disgruntled landlords, and the need to find someone to cover the evening's bill.
"I didn't notice you trying to reach me when Nas came with the police," she said, hoping at least that he would wince, but the boyish face was calm as ever, beneath clean brown hair he habitually combed back with his fingers.
"I'm sorry," he said, crushing out his Gauloise. Because she'd come to associate the smell of the dark French tobacco with him, Paris had seemed full of his scent, his ghost, his trail. "I was certain he'd never detect the nature of the piece. You must understand, once I had admitted to myself how badly we needed the money, I knew that I must act. You, I knew, were far too idealistic. The gallery would have folded in any case. If things had gone as planned, with Nas, we would be there now, and you would be happy."
"Happy," he repeated, taking another cigarette from the pack.
She could only stare at him, feeling a kind of wonder, and a sick revulsion at her desire to believe him.
"You know," he said, taking a match from the red and yellow box, "I've had difficulties with the police before, when I was a student. Politics, of course."
He struck the match, tossed the box down, and lit the cigarette.
"Politics," she said, and suddenly felt like laughing. "I was unaware that there was a party for people like you. I can't imagine what it might be called."
"Marley," he said, lowering his voice as he always did when he wished to indicate intensity of feeling. "You know, you must know, that I acted for you. For us, if you will. But surely you know, you can feel, Marley, that I would never deliberately hurt you or place you in jeopardy." There was no room on the crowded little table for her purse, so she'd held it in her lap. Now she was aware of her nails buried deep in the soft, thick leather.
"Never hurt me."
The voice was her own, lost and amazed, the voice of a child. And suddenly she was free. Free of need, desire, free of fear. And all that she felt for the handsome face across the table was simple revulsion. And she could only stare at him, this stranger she'd slept beside for 1 year, in a tiny room behind a very small gallery in the Rue Mauconseil. The waiter put her glass of Vichy down in front of her. He must have taken her silence for the beginning of acceptance, the utter blankness of her expression for openness.
"What you don't understand," this, she remembered, was a favorite opening, "is that men like Nas exist, in some sense, to support the arts. To support us, Marley."
He smiled then, as though he laughed at himself, a jaunty conspiratorial smile that chilled her now. "I suppose, though, that I should have credited the man with having at least the requisite sense to hire his own Cornell expert, although my Cornell expert, I assure you, was by far the more erudite of the two."
How was she to get away? Stand, she told herself,
Turn. Walk calmly back to the entrance. Step through the door. Out into the subdued glitter of Napoleon Court, where polished marble overlay the Rue du Champ-Fleury, a 14th-century street said to have been reserved primarily for prostitution. Anything, anything. Only go. Only leave, now, and be away. Away from him, walking blind, to lose herself in the guidebook Paris she'd learned when she'd first come here. But now, he was saying, you can see that things have worked out for the best. It's often like that, isn't it? Again the smile, but this time it was boyish, slightly wistful, and somehow horribly more intimate. We've lost the gallery, but you found employment, Marley. You have a job to do, an interesting one. And I have the connections you'll need, Marley. I know the people you'll need to meet in order to find your artist. My artist? Covering her abrupt confusion with a sip of Vichy. He opened his scarred attaché and removed something flat, a simple reflection hologram. She took it, grateful to have something to do with her hands, and saw that it was a casual shot of the box she'd seen in Viereck's construct of Barcelona. Someone was holding it forward. A man's hands, not Alain's. And on one of them, a signet ring of some dark metal. The background was lost, only the box and the hands. Alain, she said, where did you get this? Looking up to meet brown eyes filled with a terrible childlike triumph. It's going to cost someone a very great deal to find out. He ground out his cigarette and stood. Excuse me. He walked away, headed in the direction of the restrooms. As he vanished, behind mirrors and black steel beams, she dropped the hologram, reached across the table, and flipped back the lid of his attaché. There was nothing there, only a blue elastic band and some crumbs of tobacco. May I bring you something else? More Vichy, perhaps? The waiter stood beside her. She looked up at him, struck suddenly by a sense of familiarity. The lean, dark face. He's wearing a broadcast unit, the waiter said. He's armed as well. I was the bellman in Brussels. Give him what he wants. Remember that the money means nothing to you. He took her glass and placed it carefully on his tray. And very likely it will destroy him. When Alain returned, he was smiling. Now, darling, he said, reaching for his cigarettes. We can do business. Marley smiled back and nodded. 11. On site. He allowed himself 3 hours of sleep, finally, in the windowless bunker where the point team had established the command post. He'd met the rest of the site team. Ramirez was slight, nervous, perpetually wired on his own skill as a console jockey. They were depending on him, along with Jaylene Slide, on the offshore rig, to monitor cyberspace around the grid sector that held the heavily iced banks of Maas Biolabs. If Maas became aware of them, at the last moment, he might be able to provide some warning. He was also charged with relaying the medical data from the surgery to the offshore rig, a complex procedure if they were to keep it from Maas. The line out ran to a phone booth in the middle of nowhere. Once past that booth, he and Jaylene were on their own in the Matrix. If they blew it, Maas could backtrack and pinpoint the site. And then there was Nathan, the repairman, whose real job consisted of watching over the gear in the bunker. If some part of their system went down, there was at least a chance he could fix it. Nathan belonged to the species that had produced Oki and a thousand others Turner had worked with over the years, maverick techs who liked earning danger money and had proven they could keep their mouths shut. The others, Compton, Teddy, Costa, and Davis, were just expensive muscle, mercs, the sort of men you hired for a job like this. For their benefit, he'd taken particular care in questioning Sutcliffe about the arrangements for clear-out. He'd explained where the copters would come in, the order of pickup, and precisely how and when they would be paid. Then he told them to leave him alone in the bunker, and ordered Weber to wake him in 3 hours. The place had been either a pump house or some sort of nexus for electrical wiring. The stumps of plastic tubing that protruded from the walls might have been conduit or sewage line. The room provided no evidence that any of them had ever been connected to anything. The ceiling, a single slab of poured concrete, was too low to allow him to stand, and there was a dry, dusty smell that wasn't entirely unpleasant. The team had swept the place before they brought in the tables and the equipment, but there were still a few yellow flakes of newsprint on the floor that crumbled when he touched them. He made out letters, sometimes an entire word. Each of the folding metal camp tables had been set up along a wall, forming an L, each arm supporting an array of extraordinarily sophisticated communications gear, the best, he thought, that Hosaka had been able to obtain. He hunched his way carefully along the length of each table, tapping each console, each black box, lightly as he went. There was a heavily modified military sideband transceiver rigged for squirt transmission. This would be their link in case Ramirez and Jaylene flubbed the data transfer. The squirts were pre-recorded, elaborate technical fictions encoded by Hosaka's cryptographers. The content of a given squirt was meaningless, but the sequence in which they were broadcast would convey simple messages. Sequence BCA would inform Hosaka of Mitchell's arrival. FD would indicate his departure from the site, while FG would signal his death and the concurrent closure of the operation. Turner tapped the sideband rig again, frowning. He wasn't pleased with Sutcliffe's arrangements there. If the extraction was blown, it wasn't likely they'd get out, let alone get out clean. And Weber had quietly informed him that, in the event of trouble, she'd been ordered to use a handheld anti-tank rocket on the medicals in their miniature surgery. "They know," she said. "You can bet they're getting paid for it, too." The rest of them were depending on the helicopters, which were based near Tucson. Turner assumed that Maas, if alerted, would easily take them out as they came in. When he'd objected to Sutcliffe, the Australian had only shrugged. "It isn't the way I'd set it up under the best circumstances, mate, but we're all in here on short notice, aren't we?" Beside the transceiver was an elaborate Sony biomonitor, linked directly with the surgical pod and charged with the medical history recorded in Mitchell's Biosoft dossier. The medicals, when the time came, would assess the defector's history. Simultaneously, the procedures they carried out in the pod would be fed back to the Sony and collated, ready for Ramirez to ice them and ship them out into cyberspace, where Jaylene Slide would be riding shotgun from her seat in the oil rig. If it all went smoothly, the medical update would be waiting in Hosaka's Mexico City compound when Turner brought him in the jet. Turner had never seen anything quite like the Sony, but he supposed the Dutchman would have had something very similar in his Singapore clinic. The thought brought his hand to his bare chest, where he unconsciously traced the vanished line of a graft scar. The second table supported the cyberspace gear. The deck was identical with the one he'd seen on the oil rig, a Maas Neotech prototype. The deck configuration was standard, but Conroy had said that it was built up from the new biochips. There was a fist-sized lump of pale pink plastique squashed on top of the console. Someone, perhaps Ramirez, had thumbed in twin depressions for eyes and a crude curve of idiot grin. Two wires, one blue, the other yellow, ran from the thing's pink forehead to one of the black gaping tubes that protruded from the wall behind the console. Another of Weber's chores, if there seemed any danger of the site being overrun. Turner eyed the wires, frowning. A charge that size, in that small enclosed space, guaranteed death for anyone in the bunker. His shoulders aching, the back of his head brushing the rough concrete of the ceiling, he continued his inspection. The rest of the table was taken up with the deck's peripherals, a series of black boxes positioned with obsessive precision. He suspected that each unit was a certain specific distance from its neighbor, and they were perfectly aligned. Ramirez himself would have set them out, and Turner was certain that if he touched one, moved at the least fraction, the jockey would know. He'd seen that same neurotic touch before, in other console men, and it told him nothing about Ramirez. He'd watched other jockeys who reversed the trait, deliberately tangling their gear in a rat's nest of leads and cables, who were terrified of tidiness and plastered their consoles with decals of dice and screaming skulls. There was no way to tell, he thought. Either Ramirez was good, or else they all might be dead soon. At the far end of the table were five Telefunken earbead transceivers with adhesive throat mics, still sealed in individual bubble packs. During the crucial phase of the defection, which Turner took to be the 20 minutes on either side of Mitchell's arrival, he, Ramirez, Sutcliffe, Weber, and Lynch would be linked, although the use of the transceivers was to be kept to an absolute minimum. Behind the Telefunkens was an unmarked plastic carton that contained 20 Swedish catalytic hand warmers, smooth flat oblongs of stainless steel, each in its own drawstring bag of Christmas red flannelette. "You're a clever bastard," he said to the carton. "I might have thought that one up myself." He slept on a corrugated foam hiker's pad on the floor of the command post, using the parka as a blanket. Conroy had been right about the desert night, but the concrete seemed to hold the day's heat. He left his fatigues and shoes on. Weber had advised him to shake his shoes and clothing out whenever he dressed. "Scorpions," she'd say. "They like sweat, any kind of moisture." He removed the Smith & Wesson from the nylon holster before he lay down, carefully positioning it beside the foam pad. He left the two battery lanterns on and closed his eyes, and slid into a shallow sea of dream, images tossing past, fragments of Mitchell's dossier melding with bits of his own life. He and Mitchell drove a bus through a cascade of plate glass into the lobby of a Marrakesh hotel. The scientist whooped as he pressed the button that detonated the 24 canisters of CN taped along the flanks of the vehicle. And Oki was there, too, offering him whiskey from a bottle and yellow Peruvian cocaine on a round plastic-rimmed mirror he'd last seen in Allison's purse. He thought he saw Allison somewhere beyond the windows of the bus, choking in the clouds of gas, and he tried to tell Oki, tried to point her out, but the glass was plastered with Mexican holograms of saints, postcards of the Virgin, and Oki was holding up something smooth and round, a globe of pink crystal, and he saw a spider crouched at its core, a spider made of quicksilver. But Mitchell was laughing, his teeth full of blood, and extending his open palm to offer Turner the gray biosoft. Turner saw that the dossier was a brain, grayish pink and alive beneath a wet clear membrane, pulsing softly in Mitchell's hand. And then he tumbled over some submarine ledge of dream and settled smoothly down into a night with no stars at all. Weber woke him, her hard features framed in the square doorway, her shoulders draped in the heavy military blanket taped across the entrance. "Got your 3 hours. The medicals are up if you want to talk to him." She withdrew, her boots crunching gravel. Osaka's medics were waiting beside the self-contained neurosurgery. Under a desert dawn, they looked as though they'd just stepped from some kind of matter transmitter in their fashionably rumpled Ginza casuals. One of the men was bundled in an oversized Mexican handknit, the sort of belted cardigan Turner had seen tourists wear in Mexico City. The other two wore expensive-looking insulated ski jackets against the desert cold. The men were a head shorter than the Korean, a slender woman with strong archaic features and a bird-like ruff of red-tinged hair that made Turner think of raptors. Conroy had said that the two were company men, and Turner could see it easily. Only the woman had the attitude, the stance that belonged to Turner's world. And she was an outlaw, a black medic. She'd be right at home with the Dutchman, he thought. "I'm Turner," he said. "I'm in charge here." "You don't need our names," the woman said as the two Hosaka men bowed automatically. They exchanged glances, looked at Turner, then looked back to the Korean. "No," Turner said. "It isn't necessary." "Why are we still denied access to the patient's medical data?" the Korean asked. "Security," Turner said, the answer very nearly an automatic response. In fact, he could see no reason to prevent them from studying Mitchell's record. The woman shrugged, turned away, her face hidden by the upturned collar of her insulated jacket. "Would you like to inspect the surgery?" the man in the bulky cardigan asked, his face polite and alert, a perfect corporate mask.
No, Turner said. We'll be moving you out to the lot 20 minutes prior to his arrival. We'll take the wheels off, level you with Jax. The sewage link will be disconnected. I want you fully operational 5 minutes after we set you down.
There will be no problem, the other man said, smiling.
Now, I want you to tell me what you're going to be doing in there, what you'll do to him, and how it might affect him.
You don't know? The woman asked, sharply, turning back to face him.
I said that I wanted you to tell me, Turner said.
We'll conduct an immediate scan for lethal implants, the man in the cardigan said.
Cortex charges, that sort of thing?
I doubt, said the other man, that we will encounter anything so crude. But yes, we will be scanning for the full range of lethal devices. Simultaneously, we'll run a full blood screen. We understand that his current employers deal in extremely sophisticated biochemical systems. It would seem possible that the greatest danger would lie in that direction.
It's currently quite fashionable to equip top employees with modified insulin pump subdermals, his partner broke in. The subject's system can be tricked into an artificial reliance on certain synthetic enzyme analogs. Unless the subdermal is recharged at regular intervals, withdrawal from the source, the employer, can result in trauma.
We are prepared to deal with that as well, said the other.
Neither of you are even remotely prepared to deal with what I suspect we will encounter, the black medic said, her voice as cold as the wind that blew out of the east now.
Turner heard sand hissing across the rusted sheet of steel above them.
You, Turner said to her. Come with me.
Then he turned, without looking back, and walked away. It was possible that she might not obey his command, in which case he'd lose face with the other two, but it seemed the right move. When he was 10 meters from the surgery pod, he halted. He heard her feet on the gravel.
What do you know? He asked without turning.
Perhaps no more than you do, she said. Perhaps more.
More than your colleagues, obviously.
They are extremely talented men. They are also servants.
And you are not.
Neither are you, mercenary. I was hired out of the finest unlicensed clinic in Chiba for this. I was given a great deal of material to study in preparation for my meeting with this illustrious patient. The black clinics of Chiba are the cutting edge of medicine. Not even Hosaka could know that my position in black medicine would allow me to guess what it is that your defector carries in his head. The street tries to find its own uses for things, Mr. Turner. Already, several times, I've been hired to attempt the removal of these new implants. A certain amount of advanced mass biocircuitry has found its way into the market. These attempts at implanting are a logical step. I suspect mass may leak these things deliberately.
Then explain it to me.
I don't think I could, she said, and there was a strange hint of resignation in her voice. I told you I've seen it. I didn't say that I understood it.
Fingertips suddenly brushed the skin beside his skulljack.
This, compared with biochip implants, is like a wooden staff beside a myoelectric limb.
But will it be life-threatening in his case?
Oh, no, she said, withdrawing her hand. Not for him.
And then he heard her trudging back toward the surgery. Conroy sent a runner in with the software package that would allow Turner to pilot the jet that would carry Mitchell to Hosaka's Mexico City compound. The runner was a wild-eyed, sun-blackened man Lynch called Harry, a rope-muscled apparition who came cycling in from the direction of Tucson on a sand-scoured bike with balding lug tires and bone-yellow rawhide laced around its handlebars. Lynch led Harry across the parking lot. Harry was singing to himself, a strange sound in the enforced quiet of the site, and his song, if you could call it that, was like someone randomly tuning a broken radio up and down midnight miles of dial, bringing in gospel shouts and snatches of 20 years of international pop. Harry had his bike slung across one burnt, bird-thin shoulder.
Harry's got something for you from Tucson, Lynch said.
You two know each other? Turner asked, looking at Lynch.
Maybe have a friend in common?
What's that supposed to mean? Lynch asked. Turner held his stare.
You know his name?
He told me his fucking name, Turner.
Name's Harry, the burnt man said. He tossed the bicycle down on a clump of brush. He smiled vacantly, exposing badly spaced eroded teeth. His bare chest was filmed with sweat and dust, and hung with loops of fine steel chain, rawhide, bits of animal horn and fur, brass cartridge casings, copper coins worn smooth and faceless with use, and a small pouch made of soft brown leather. Turner looked at the assortment of things strung across the skinny chest and reached out, flipping a crooked bit of bent gristle suspended from a length of braided string.
What the hell is that, Harry?
That's a coon's pecker, Harry said. Coon's got him a jointed bone in his pecker. Not many as know that.
You ever meet my friend Lynch before, Harry?
Harry blinked.
He had the passwords, Lynch said. There's an urgency hierarchy. He knew the top. He told me his name. Do you need me here, or can I get back to work?
Go, Turner said.
When Lynch was out of earshot, Harry began to work at the thongs that sealed the leather pouch.
You shouldn't be harsh with the boy, he said. He's really very good. I actually didn't see him until he had that Fletcher up against my neck.
He opened the pouch and fished delicately inside.
Tell Conroy I've got him pegged.
Sorry? Harry said, extracting a folded sheet of yellow notebook paper from his pouch.
You've got who pegged?
He handed it to Turner. There was something inside.
Lynch. He's Conroy's bum boy on the site. Tell him.
He unfolded the paper and removed the fat military Microsoft. There was a note in blue capitals. Break a leg, asshole. See you in the DF.
Do you really want me to tell him that?
Tell him.
You're the boss.
You fucking know it, Turner said, crumpling the paper and thrusting it into Harry's left armpit. Harry smiled, sweetly and vacantly, and the intelligence that had risen in him settled again, like some aquatic beast sinking effortlessly down into a smooth sea of sun-addled vapidity. Turner stared into his eyes, cracked yellow opal, and saw nothing there but sun and the broken highway. A hand with missing joints came up to scratch absently at a week's growth of beard.
Now, Turner said.
Harry turned, pulled his bike up from the tangle of brush, shouldered it with a grunt, and began to make his way back across the ruined parking lot. His oversized, tattered khaki shorts flapped as he went, and his collection of chains rattled softly. Sutcliffe whistled from a rise 20 meters away, held up a roll of orange surveyor's tape. It was time to start laying out Mitchell's landing strip. They'd have to work quickly, before the sun was too high. And still it was going to be hot.
So, Weber said, he's coming in by air.
She spat brown juice on a yellowed cactus. Her cheek was packed with Copenhagen snuff.
You got it, Turner said.
He sat beside her on a ledge of buff shale. They were watching Lynch and Nathan clear the strip he and Sutcliffe had laid out with the orange tape. The tape marked out a rectangle 4 meters wide and 20 long. Lynch carried a length of rusted I-beam to the tape and heaved it over. Something scurried away through the brush as the beam rang on concrete.
They can see that tape if they want to, Weber said, wiping her lips with the back of her hand.
Read the headlines on your morning fax if they want to.
I know, Turner said. But if they don't know we're here already, I don't think they're going to. And you couldn't see it from the highway.
He adjusted the black nylon cap Ramirez had given him, pulling the long bill down until it touched his sunglasses.
Anyway, we're just moving the heavy stuff, the things that could tear a leg off. It isn't going to look like anything, not from orbit.
No, Weber agreed, her seamed face impassive beneath her sunglasses. He could smell her sweat from where she sat, sharp and animal.
What the hell do you do, Weber, when you aren't doing this?
He looked at her. Probably a hell of a lot more than you do, she said. Part of the time I breed dogs. She took a knife from her boot and began to strop it patiently on her sole, flipping it smoothly with each stroke, like a Mexican barber sharpening a razor. And I fish. Trout. You have people in New Mexico? Probably more than you've got, she said flatly. I figure the ones like you and Sutcliffe, you aren't from any place at all. This is where you live, isn't it, Turner? On the site, today, the day your boy comes out, right? She tested the blade against the ball of her thumb, then slid it back into its sheath. But you have people? You got a man to go back to? A woman, you want to know, she said. Know anything about breeding dogs? No, he said. I didn't think so. She squinted at him. We got a kid, too. Ours. She carried it. DNA splice? She nodded. That's expensive, he said. You know it. Wouldn't be here if we didn't need to pay it off. But she's beautiful. Your woman? Our kid. 12. Café Blanc. As she walked from the Louvre, she seemed to sense some articulated structure shifting to accommodate her course through the city. The waiter would be merely a part of the thing, one limb, a delicate probe or palp. The whole would be larger, much larger. How could she have imagined that it would be possible to live, to move, in the unnatural field of Virek's wealth without suffering distortion? Virek had taken her up in all her misery, and had rotated her through the monstrous, invisible stresses of his money, and she had been changed. Of course, she thought. Of course. It moves around me constantly, watchful and invisible, the vast and subtle mechanism of Herr Virek's surveillance. Eventually she found herself on the pavement below the terrace of the Blanc. It seemed as good a place as any. A month before, she would have avoided it. She'd spent too many evenings with Alain there. Now, feeling that she had been freed, she decided to begin the process of rediscovering her own Paris by choosing a table at the Blanc. She took one near a side screen. She asked a waiter for a cognac and shivered, watching the Paris traffic flow past, perpetual river of steel and glass, while all around her, at other tables, strangers ate and smiled, drank and argued, said bitter goodbyes or swore private fealties to an afternoon's feeling. But, she smiled, she was a part of it all. Something in her was waking from a long and stifled sleep, brought back into the light in the instant she'd fully opened her eyes to Alain's viciousness and her own desperate need to continue loving him. But that need was fading, even as she sat here. The shabbiness of his lies, somehow, had broken the chains of her depression. She could see no logic to it, because she had known, in some part of herself, and long before the business with Nas, exactly what it was that Alain did in the world, and that had made no difference to her love. In the face of this new feeling, however, she would forego logic. It was enough to be here, alive, at a table in the Blanc, and to imagine all around her the intricate machine that she now knew Virek had deployed. Ironies, she thought, seeing the young waiter from Napoleon Court step up onto the terrace. He wore the dark trousers he had worked in, but the apron had been replaced with a blue windbreaker. Dark hair fell across his forehead in a smooth wing. He came toward her, smiling, confident, knowing that she wouldn't run. There was something in her then that wanted very badly to run, but she knew that she wouldn't. Irony, she told herself. As I luxuriate in the discovery that I am no special sponge for sorrow, but merely another fallible animal in this stone maze of a city, I come simultaneously to see that I am the focus of some vast device fueled by an obscure desire. My name is Paco, he said, pulling out the white-painted iron chair opposite her own. You were the child, the boy, in the park. A long time ago, yes. He sat. Señor has preserved the image of my childhood. I have been thinking about your señor.
She didn't look at him, but at the passing cars, cooling her eyes in the flow of traffic, the colors of polycarbon and painted steel. A man like Viereck is incapable of divesting himself of his wealth. His money has a life of its own, perhaps a will of its own. He implied as much when we met.
You are a philosopher.
I'm a tool, Paco. I'm the most recent tip for a very old machine in the hands of a very old man who wishes to penetrate something and has so far failed to do so. Your employer fumbles through 1,000 tools and somehow chooses me.
You are a poet as well.
End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.